Hello, this is The Leg Show. We're going to get started in just a couple minutes here. In the meantime, if you have IRC access, be sure to join us at irc.thelinuxshow.com and channel Pound Linux Show. So hang in there. We'll get started right after these messages.
You're listening to The Linux Show. Or maybe you're thinking about it. I don't know. This is probably a commercial. Want to find out about Linux and open source? Check us out at www.linuxshow.com for the best in Linux community news. Check us out.
And we're back.
It is the Linux Show. We are back for our regular Tuesday night edition of the weekly Linux Show. Here it is, October. Man, oh man, time continues to fly by week after week. And we're here pretty much in a full score this week. We got here's the irony. The theme for the second half of our show later on tonight is going to be education. So I was really looking forward to Arnie participating, being as that he is an educator in his own right. But Arnie is trapped in the midterms are due tomorrow at 8 o'clock syndrome, and he had to bow out of tonight's show at the last minute. But the rest of us are here in full force. Doc, how are you doing tonight?
I'm doing good. Doing good. I'm going to be the last show from this house. We're moving about a mile away, about 2 miles by car, about 7 minutes by station wagon, hauling crap from one place to the other. And going to get a whole new setup going over there. One of the things I intend to do is put together a quiet Linux box, that is to say, you know, probably a build-it-myself thing that doesn't have any fan noise. There are several suppliers out there that do that. And so they sort of want to inaugurate the new place by getting a box that doesn't exacerbate my tinnitus, which apparently has been traced to computer noise. So that's one of the ideas. It's a beautiful place, and it's very complicated moving, but there we are.
Well, I've got two observations for you. Number one is I'm hoping you're still going to have broadband internet.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's news relating to that of why I'm concerned.
Really?
Yeah. And the other observation I will give is that I guess that means that about 3 or 4 weeks from now, your wife is going to start looking for the new home.
Well, in this case, just to make a long story as short as possible, what makes this very complicated is we bought a piece of property that we're going to divide in two, and we're going to fix up the house that's on the one half and sell it and use to build a house you want on the other half, and we're renting a house next to both halves that has an adjacent address that's almost identical to the one that we're renting. So we're actually renting out the one that we're going to renovate while we do the architecture on it for several months to some students. So we have a rental that we're renting from and a rental that we're renting to that we're going to destroy and rebuild in another place.
My brain hurts already.
Yeah, it does. My brain hurts too. It's very complicated to explain. I was trying to explain it to the gardener today when he was coming by, the guy who's going to work on that for both places. And there was a language barrier there as well. I'm not sure I communicated anything. Anyhow, so that's... that's the story. I do hope we get broadband there. I mean, if Cox high-speed internet still operates, I think we're going to be okay.
Well, yeah, make sure you let me know, because by hook or by crook, I'll get broadband to your house, because when we get into the news segment, I've got news.
Okay.
Well, out on the opposite end of the country, Russ, how are you doing tonight?
Oh, hanging in. Nice night out here. In fact, true to form for Washington, D.C., they're expecting weather in the 80s here in the beginning of October, which is weird, but hey, welcome to Washington.
Yeah, well, I don't doubt it one bit, because once again, it was bizarre here in Chicago over the weekend. We hit 50 on Sunday, and today it almost hit 90.
Yep.
Wow.
And so just bizarre things are the norm for the Windy City. That's for damn sure. And Kevin, how are you doing tonight? Kevin's going to be doing something special for us tonight. We're going to be having a review of Red Hat 8.2. How are you doing, Kevin?
Oh, not too bad.
And again, like last week, got to make, I guess this is official, we're no longer broadcasting live from Aurora, Illinois. We are officially ensconced into our new facilities in Chicago. More and more bandwidth will be installed into that facility as the time goes on. And so for those of you out there listening or those in the IRC, make sure you guys do me a favor because my client is broken right at the moment. So jump into the IRC and make sure you tell the people in IRC this as well, that we will have lots more streams available in the very near future as more circuits get installed into the Chicago POP. So we're still looking for that to happen sometime in the next 3 to 5 week time frame. But I'm going to go ahead and jump right into the first segment because I've got news that's Linux Show news. In fact, this news is so new, so cool. I haven't even told Kevin yet. And it's because I've been keeping my mouth shut because I've sort of promised this one too many times, and we have gotten stopped in our attempts to actually pull this off. But it is now absolutely official. It is the contracts are worked out. They are signed. It is in the bag. We are going to be launching very shortly an appendum to the weekly edition of the Linux Show, and there's going to be a new monthly. And the big difference between the show we do now and the show that we're going to do monthly is the monthly show is going to be a one-hour video show. And it's,
wow.
It's going to be done on cable TV. And we are going to distribute.
Jeff's World.
Yep.
It is
Jeff. Jeff's World. I've been negotiating the contract with the local cable affiliate here for well over a year. Finally, getting all the legalities of doing a commercial broadcast on a public access channel. But finally got it worked out, and so it's happening. And so, Doc, that's why we need broadband. We got to have it because we're going to be shipping out equipment across the country to everybody on the panel. So you've got little cameras you can plug into your computers at home, and we're going to line up a wall full of monitors and have talking heads.
Oh, I'll just train the camera on a still picture of me with clothing on, and we'll be done.
Doc, this is cable. We can do the show nude.
Actually, because it's cable, you could do the show nude and no one would notice.
Probably. But, no, we got plans. There's a couple of various Linux companies across the country who are going to be acting as distributors for me in various markets across the country of getting tapes of the program delivered to cable affiliates around the country. And so we ought to start popping up in markets across the country pretty rapidly. I've got pretty good faith in this. This is going to spread rather rapidly. If the formula of the webcast holds true, I think the video will hold true as well. The major impediment to pulling this off was really negotiating a price. Production costs on video are pretty high, and we finally negotiated them down to a price point that we could actually afford within the cash flow of our normal business operations. And so we're probably just going to look for one or two underwriters to underwrite the staff costs for the in-studio staff. And that's probably going to only end up costing like $250 a month. So I don't anticipate that's going to be really difficult to underwrite. It's a pretty small amount of money. But that's the big news out of the Linux show broadcast studios. So, Doc, what's your hot story of the week, as if I don't know? Doc?
I was busy scampering around waiting for pages to load and stuff. Right now we're in the midst of a real drama around the continuing stay of execution for internet radio in the U.S. There's Representative Sensenbrenner of Wisconsin, I think it's with Madison, from Madison, Wisconsin, introduced a bill that would simply delay the enactment of the fees of the copyright fees imposed by the CARP and the Library of Congress for 6 months while Congress would have a chance to review the situation. And there was some optimism about the chances for that, because all it did was just simply said, let's hold off on this thing for 6 months so we have a chance to go back and look at it. And then yesterday, Representative Conyers of Michigan sent a letter to everybody in Congress, either co-signed or backed by about every major union you can name. It was impressive, saying it was completely specious. I mean, it said that
it was a letter full of lies. Doug.
It was a letter full of lies. Artists have been denied their payments for too long, and these stations should have held some money in abeyance and so forth and so on. Absolutely without any foundation in reality. The guy needs to be taken down. he moved to the front, as far as I'm concerned.
Yep.
You know,
well,
he moved all the way. I mean, he moved in front of Hollings. It was really, really sad. Anyway, so it got derailed. It got pulled back. It got pulled off the docket, or whatever you call it. I understand from Bill Goldsmith and from others, and if you go to RAIN, the Radio and Internet Newsletter, which is at kurthanson.com, KURTHANSON.com, there's a sort of blow-by-blow about it, but supposedly we're going to find out something by Friday, and the rumors are that they are working on a percentage of revenue basis, which is what the stations have been wanting for a long time. So while the RIAA has been playing hardball all along, apparently this thing is still going on. I just got a note from Bill a few minutes ago saying, stay tuned.
But if they want a percentage of revenues and someone's losing money, are they going to give money?
That's a good question. Maybe they should get money back.
Yeah, maybe they should, because radio stations that are losing money by promoting their product should get paid for promoting their product, just like they pay the on-air broadcasters to play their product.
Right, exactly. I know.
Okay.
These guys are busy paying the on-air broadcasters to carry songs, and they're busy wanting to charge the internet broadcasters.
Now, I'm not joking about that point. I'm not making light of this.
Yeah.
I'm serious.
Yeah, you think there's a revenue model there.
Okay, I think if they're serious about that they want to charge, that they need to look at the other side of the equation, that the broadcasters are risking enormous amounts of money to get this new industry started, and it's not generating income. And so the least we can expect out of the content providers is a little kickback for promoting their content.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's only fair, taking into consideration what they are presently doing with the broadcast model.
Yeah.
It's only fair. Well, I'm glad you heard from Bill. That's a good story.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't much. He just said, I asked if he's in the thick of it, and he wrote back and said, yeah, he is, and we might be able to talk tomorrow. I can't talk to him tomorrow. Maybe you could give him a call.
I think I will give him a call.
Because I'm going to be hauling stuff back and forth in trucks and stuff like that, so I'm not even going to be around. I think I'm really going to go dark for a while, as it were. But that's sort of the big thing that's going on at the moment. An additional context about this for Digital Hollywood. I had a metaphor that came to me after watching a short movie by Pixar called For the Birds. It runs before most of their movies. A bunch of birds are on a wire, and then this goofy-looking bird comes along, and they don't like him there, and they peck at his feet until all of a sudden the wire snaps and all the birds are launched into space, leaving their feathers behind. Well, those are the record companies. And this is their customers, and it's Napster, and it's Nutella, and the rest of it that has shown up and is not welcome. And as soon as when they're through killing it, it's going to launch them. It is one of the things that came across in Digital Hollywood was there was a guy, an entertainer, which unfortunately only distributes for Windows, but he nailed it. I mean, while everybody else on the panels was saying that everything's hunky-dory and all the rest of it, he said, you guys are worried about pirates. In the meantime, your business model is going away. He said, how many people here have TiVos? Almost everybody raised their hand. Nobody had a laptop, by the way, except for me. He said, how many people have TiVos? And everybody raised their hand. He said, how many people, and don't lie, yours is fast-forward to get through the ads. And everybody left their hand up in the air. And he said, in the meantime, all these big companies up here on stage are carrying up to $30 billion in debt. And they're increasing the number of stations that are supported only by advertising, and there's less advertising than ever. And by the way, once PVRs go to the next stage, people will be able to bypass the advertising. End of business model. There's a problem. You want a problem? There's a problem.
Yeah, that's a problem. And a problem they deserve. They absolutely deserve. But any other stories for us this week, or is that just what you've been focused on?
Yeah, that'll do it for now.
I mean, that's been a major focus, I think, of just about...
Yeah, it's a major focus of mine, and it's a place where I want Linux business to happen. I thought it was rather interesting that nobody had a laptop, but everybody had a Linux device.
Yep. on a side note to this story, although GeekPack is still waiting for official certification by the Federal Elections Committee, speaking of which, I'll have a side note on that in a second, I have officially elevated Connors up to the heads on Pike list.
Oh, no, yeah, absolutely.
Before GeekPack.
Oh, absolutely.
He's number one in line for the heads on Pike's list.
Yeah, yeah.
And I don't care if we can't beat him. That guy is something else. But, again, side note on the development. Side note on the development of GeekPack in relation to this story is that I will be meeting with lawyers tomorrow to fill out some addendum forms that were sent to the lawyers by the Federal Election Committee, and it is the belief of the lawyers that shortly after these documents are processed that we will be able to actually operate as a political organization. Might end up being too late for the election, though. So it's
I think we need to be targeting...
the next election.
Right.
But still...
It's almost like a video game, or a game where, all of the submarines have gone by.
Yep.
But we're waiting for the next round of submarines to go by.
Yeah, but the incredible thing is how long it takes to wade through all of the political mire in our government.
It really has
been a very disgusting adventure I have been on. I have a story I'll jump in with right now, and I'm sure everybody is aware of it. And that is, we got a whole bunch of anniversaries this week. And I know Russ is going to talk about one of those anniversaries, but I'll throw in the first one, and that being the anniversary of Linux Today as a community entity. And so I asked Brian Proffitt, the current editor of Linux Today, to join us tonight. Brian, you still there?
I am still here.
And, well, Brian, hey, happy birthday.
Thank you. Thank you very much. On behalf of all the editors that have worked at Linux Today, it's been a great effort so far, and we've come a long way in 4 years, and we're really pleased to be here.
Well, yeah, it's gratifying just to survive for one thing.
Yeah, that's a big part of it. I mean, when the .com implosion happened, I mean there were some dicey moments. Here and there, and we seem to have survived, and things are running pretty smoothly now, and we're looking forward to the future.
Yeah, I am too. I'm looking forward to things continuing to move into the future. Have you, now that you've reached the fourth anniversary, I know there's been some talk that I have heard rumbling around that you're going to take the fact that you'll survive these four odd years and that internet.com has evolved into Jupiter, that you guys are going to start moving into event planning. Yeah, is that true?
That is true. Actually, we've been moving into events planning for quite some time. Internet.com, which is still how I call the company, they've been doing events, specialized events for IT seminars for quite some time. But this in December, we are doing our first Linux event in Boston. And we're really, it's looking pretty good. We've got a fairly good lineup of guests right now who are speaking. And it's going to be less of a trade show like Linux World Expo and more of a an IT seminar kind of thing.
Yeah, well, I think that's sensible. I think the time frame that we're still at right now, conferences are more practical than trade shows. I think it's just the case of the way it is right now.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes sense. So is there anything else that you see as editor that's going to be an evolution or a change to look forward to?
Well, we've always run this really careful balance between serving the community, which is really where our audience is, and also providing more enterprise and corporate directed news feeds. And I think we've done a pretty good job so far. I'm trying to swing it back a little bit the other way and get more community-oriented news on the site. And get more of a balance. We've got the enterprise level and corporate news coming in at a very steady clip, and we're trying to introduce some ways to get more community news out there, because I still think that's a very prevalent part of Linux.
Yep. Now, I don't know if this is a statistic you can publicly state or not, but how many hits are you guys generating? What kind of traffic are you generating now that you've got 4 years of maturity under your belt?
We're running about plus 500,000 a day, page hits a day, which that's a running average. It goes up and goes down, obviously. So we're actually, our traffic has increased something along the lines of 20% just in the year and a half that I've been working on the site, first as a contributing editor and then as a managing editor.
Hmm.
So we've got the traffic. And everything else is coming along, the revenue's coming in, and so, we feel pretty comfortable with the way things are.
I would think so.
Yeah.
A million hits a day, that's got to generate a little money.
Yeah. Yeah, it's actually really, it's really mind-boggling. We just got some new online reporting software that shows me the stats, and without going into great detail, I'm stunned by the numbers and just the diversity of where people are coming from. We still have mostly an American audience, but we're getting a much larger group of people coming in from Europe and also South America and the Pacific regions are big. Like New Zealand.
Yeah, New Zealand, Australia is our second biggest market.
Yeah, they're great. I love them. We've got so many really good, contributors and people who participate in the talkbacks on Linux today from Australia and New Zealand. And they're good because they make my job a lot easier, because when they contribute, it's usually in the middle of my night, you know. So I have these great stories up and ready for me first thing in the morning when I get to work.
It's handy.
Yeah, it is.
Actually get to sleep.
Yeah, well, yeah, sleep is sometimes an option when you're running a 24-hour website, but thus far it hasn't been too bad.
Yeah. Well, I can certainly appreciate that, that's for sure. Well, Brian, continued luck and many, many more years of hanging in there, and as well as my own personal thanks, not only to you, but, boy, since day one, the Linux Show has had a relationship with Linux Today from Dave and Dwight on forward. The two organizations have always cooperated together quite friendly, and it's been a very gratifying relationship throughout our history. And it's always helpful to have somebody nice to deal with to get our posts up quick. So I appreciate everything that you've done for us over the years.
No problem. We're always, you know, we're the Linux Show is one of those community pictures that we're always going to be happy to assist. I look forward to hearing more about your TV cable show endeavor, and hopefully we can get the word spread out on that when the time is appropriate. And thank you very much for kind birthday wishes.
Okay. Thanks for joining us.
Take care.
We'll talk to you soon.
All right, bye-bye.
Russ, do you have a hot story of the week for us?
Yeah, I got a few, but before I go into it, quickly from the IRC, and sorry guys out on the IRC because we're having server problems. We'll keep getting knocked off here. But the IRC folks want to know whether the video Linux show might either be available on a webcast or perhaps on a monthly DVD.
It's going to be one of the two.
One of the two.
Yes. I am negotiating out, right at the moment, the open source public domain video streaming server that we would need doesn't exist. And so we would have to go with a closed source product, such as Real, and that would require us negotiating out a deal, because I utterly refuse to pay for a Real server. I'm not going to do it. And so unless we can negotiate out a deal with Real to provide us with free technology, that it's not going to happen. So what we'll probably do is go out and buy a DVD recorder and cut our own DVDs and just mail them out in the interim until we can have some kind of a video streaming.
And encode them as DVD format, I guess.
Probably.
Yeah.
May not, but probably. In fact, I was out today looking at DVD recorders specifically for this purpose.
Mm-hmm.
Now, pricey, but it would work in the interim. And here again, you know, for some reason I'm willing to pay $500 for a DVD recorder, and I'm not willing to pay for a Real stream server. I don't know if I can get myself to do it. So, I don't know, maybe we can work out a sponsor.
I wonder if anybody's doing anything with Helix. You know, the
I haven't seen anything that really works, Doc.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah.
And we've been patiently waiting for it for a long, 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 long time. It'll eventually get there. And ultimately the goal, Russ, thing is they're asking out there is, yeah, we want to stream the video show. Part of the deal that I've worked out with this cable company is that we're going to teach them how to build audio streaming servers so that they can then start making better use of their studio facilities by opening up studios to audio broadcast over their cable network as well. So they're really excited about the opportunities they're going to be opening up to them. And certainly, you know, it's a cable company, so they probably have plenty of bandwidth of their own that they can allocate to something like that. But I don't want to shortcut your time, so what other stories do you have this week?
Well, as you mentioned or alluded to, not only is Linux today 4 years old, but a little website that very few people know about, it's called Slashdot, is 5 years old today. And I think it really is amazing when you think about it that Slashdot, Linux Today, Linux Weekly News have all survived. In an era when in the dot-com world, 18 months seem to run pretty much a corporate lifetime, we have three community-based news services which have survived, and if not thriving, they're at least holding their own. I mean, LWN was having the biggest problem, and they seem to have hopefully turned the corner, and maybe they will be able to keep themselves running that with their subscription model.
Yep.
But this is really great stuff, frankly, that this has been able to happen.
Just so I can get on the record, next week is our fifth year.
Oh, wow. Here we go. Now it's all over the place. This is definitely not dot-com area that we're in here.
Yeah, well, still can't get anybody to pay any subscription. But scraping by is maybe the best way to do it.
My second thing tonight, you can file under stupid patent tricks. And my riddle for the evening is, why is the U.S. Patent Office like Halloween? And the answer, of course, is that people are wandering around with their hands out and getting all sorts of good treats, and at the same time, there's some very frightening things happening. And this is really shown, and we can find it out on Slashdot tonight, about the story about how someone is basically suing eBay for the entire concept of a internet-driven auction site. Mr. Bill Simon apparently claims that he has the patents on just about everything that eBay does. eBay is pointing to some prior art from a Mr. Choi Heng-Hua, who while with DEC, Digital Equipment, back in 1994, actually outlined an auction site a set of rules which come very close to eBay, while participating in a stamp collecting news group. Now, you know, the thing that comes to my mind is that if some intelligent person could outline a concept in a news group that has nothing to do with the concept itself, then perhaps the patent office has gone just a little overboard awarding a patent in this area.
Yeah. Doc, correct me. You're also an old-time CompuServe guy like I am.
Yeah.
We had auctions that were live auctions where people would be online typing in bids.
Yeah.
Back in like 1978, 79.
Yeah, I never did it, but yeah, you're right. There were online auctions, there's no doubt about it.
I'm sure it was that.
And there have been online systems going back to, I worked with one called the American Information Exchange, AMEX, in 1989, the whole purpose of which was to create an online marketplace, in that case for information, for knowledge. But it could be for, you know, it could be for anything for that matter, but it just happened to be set up for advice, as it were, to create a marketplace for that. It's specious. It's, you know, more of the same.
Yeah, I really do think that it's time that the relatives of Mozart and Beethoven start suing people for the use of chords.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's just that, it's that absurd. So, any more stories, Russ?
Well, the last thing I had, and I don't know if you want me to get into it tonight or not, because it's getting a little late, was my little time shifter box that I alluded to last week. is indeed working now. And it was built for about $300. It's a little bit less than the size of a VCR. It has a nice little Celeron 400 megahertz processor in it. It's basically made out of garbage and cheap shit, but it's running Mandrake Linux and doing a marvelous job for me. As it
tell you what we'll do. You got a digital camera?
Yes, I do.
Okay, why don't we take some pics, put them up on the website, put together a parts list, and let's hold this off for next week.
All righty.
Okay, because I'm going to let Kevin do his half of the Red Hat review, and I'm going to hold off on my part of it till next week, because I haven't had a chance to get my parts list for the RAID array server that we built up on the site yet. So we'll do those two hardware projects and post them out to the website for next week's show. And
right.
But Kevin, let's jump over to you. I've been telling everybody for the last 2 weeks that you've been making use of the Beta 8 and have now got full and complete downloads. Tell us your opinion. How is it running?
Well, it's pretty slick, but unfortunately it is a .0 release, and that's showing in a couple places. The unified desktop is definitely very cool. It has a very cool look and feel, although I haven't actually given it a bona fide grandparent test, but it is pretty logically laid out. And it is nice having the unified look and feel between GNOME and KDE. Personally, I like it, although a lot of the purists are complaining about mingling of the two, but that's all integrated very well. One of the complaints I have is that it ships with Mozilla as the standard browser instead of Galleon, so you don't have full GNOME interoperability there, although it is using GNOME 2.
There was a reason for that, wasn't there?
Yeah, well, there isn't a fully GNOME 2 happy Mozilla build readily available. There are instructions on how to build it and getting Galleon 2 in, but there isn't an official Galleon 2 release yet.
Yeah, that's what I thought that it was what I read.
And it is shipping in the Internet. There is an instant messenger icon which runs Game, which is really turning out to be one of my favorite GNOME apps. It seamlessly operates with AOL's instant messenger, Yahoo's instant messenger, MSN's instant messenger, Jabber, and IRC. In fact, that's what I've been doing the show with for the last couple weeks, and it's just really working flawlessly on everything.
You've been using Game as an IRC client?
Yep.
Well, seeing as my IRC client crapped out on me just before the show, maybe I'll have to give that a try this next week.
One interesting note, on my computer here at home, it has a rather sad and pathetic motherboard that requires custom compiling a kernel to actually get it to run at all. And when I did an upgrade, which usually with Red Hat just means hopelessly clobbering everything, it actually left my original kernel from 7.3 and installed 8 around it, which I was very impressed with.
Really?
Yeah.
Huh.
Okay, another note is due to Fraunhofer's changing of their license, there are no MP3 players in Red Hat 8, although it took me a total of about 10 minutes to build XMS MMS RPMs with MP3 in it.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's a political thing on the part of Red Hat. And
yeah, hopefully that'll go away. That's just annoying.
Yeah, annoying, but I actually admire them for doing it. So, any other comments? We can hold off some more until next week if you need more time.
Yeah, I haven't really got a whole lot into using it as a server. I've mainly been getting into the desktop as a that is the main thing. It does have a fairly nifty RPM package manager, and they have modified RPM yet again, so now all of the building functions use a new binary called RPM build instead of RPM doing everything, so that takes a little getting used to.
Yep. A little further comment about the part of the review that we're holding off till next week is one of the things that I decided that we're going to do, as a part of the regularly following shows, is we are going to be publishing an ongoing treatise of the development of the server for the website, the soon-to-come website, Radio Free Universe, that we're working on with Wild Bill at Radio Paradise. And step one of that is we're going to do, as a part of this Red Hat review, we're going to give everybody the notes on exactly how we built the server from the hardware and the operating system standpoint. And as server modules for the streamingware and the managementware become available, we'll put the links to those on the website for download so that people can start building their own streaming servers that are totally capable of tracking all of the BMI ASCAP information that the people in Radioland are required to do to make sure that they pay their royalty fees. So check us out next week when we have that conversation. Again, we'll have some notes, diagrams, and photographs on the website for both the streaming server and Russ's project. And so, boy, it's going to be a geek-intensive show next week, I guess. So it'll be interesting. But let's go ahead and take a very, very short break. We're running way behind, as usual. It's 8:44. We're 15 minutes behind. We already have our guests on the line for segment number two. So, Kevin, take us out of here with a short break. Everybody hang in there. We'll come back with chapter two, part two of The Linux Show for Tuesday, first week of October 2002. Everybody hang in. We'll be right back.
I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the sponsors who make The Linux Show possible. I'd like to thank VA Linux. Oops, no, they're not VA Linux anymore. They are now VA Software. Hope they don't change their name again pretty soon. I'm going to have to make another commercial. But check out VA Software and learn all about the SourceForge development platform for internal company development projects. Or if you're just a little guy but want to get a flavor of it all, check out sourceforge.net and spread the word on open source development platforms.
October 2002. We're talking about Linux and education, specifically sort of the way this panel that we're going to be talking to tonight got put together is I, being a teacher of college students, I'm always interested in what's going on in educational avenues with Linux these days. I've seen a lot of various .orgs, various projects get started and fail in both curriculum development, software development, a lot of areas. So whenever I hear stories about people who are doing things with Linux, I get very interested. And so as we were working towards putting this show together, for some reason my eye was caught by a number of different people who were doing various things with Linux, and in particular a couple of the people who are on our panel have in one way, shape, or form participated in the creation of Beowulf clusters within their various school systems. A couple of years ago, this was sort of a big trend in southern Illinois. It seemed like every time a Linux user group would get together, we would sort of advocate a Beowulf cluster building event, and a lot of them were held at junior colleges and high schools across the southern half of Illinois. And I've gathered together these people, and I'm going to go ahead and introduce them, and they'll all talk about themselves for a little bit, and we'll move forward on just answering a few of the questions in terms of not only what are people doing with Linux as an infrastructure base like Beowulf clustering, but what are some of the real applications that you may or may not be using within your schools. So I have a panel of Pete, Alex, and Stan that I'm going to go ahead and let them introduce themselves and their affiliations. And in particular, I want Alex to tell everybody his age, because I think everybody will be shocked when they hear this. This is very reminiscent of our friend from Fat Linux, for those of you who are regular listeners. But Pete, why don't you tell us all about it, about yourself. Welcome to the Linux Show.
Oh, thank you. My name is Pete Finage. I live in Toronto, Canada. I've been involved with the Simple End User Linux project for, about 4 years now. Just came on a little while after it started. And we're an open source advocacy, hosting, and development group. The educational project was founded by a gentleman named Doug Loss out of Pennsylvania, I believe about 2.5-3 years ago, and he's done a great deal of work to bring as many people together as possible to try to foster the use of, to act as a lightning rod to get people together who are interested in Linux and education. About 2 years ago, Doug and I wrote an editorial on the state of Linux in education, and we revisited that about 2 months ago now. So I'm definitely an advocate. I've worked in the educational system for a while in adult ed, and now I work at the University of Toronto. Although it's not specifically an educational posting, it is more, and we're actually applying technology, Linux, to research. But I'm trying to stay in education because there's a lot of really neat things going on. Yeah, that's me.
Okay. Now, let's focus on you for just a couple minutes, and then we'll introduce our other panelists.
Mm-hmm.
At least from your perspective, being a Canadian, seeing what's going on north of the Canada-U.S. border, is Linux making any headway outside of the infrastructure type of use? Is it entering the curriculum yet?
It It depends on where you are. I'm aware of a few projects, especially in BC, where a large section of the school board, and unfortunately it escapes me right now. I can dig this up at a later point if you'd like. I'd be more than happy to. One of our one of the people involved with SUL /edu, Steve's been working, taking a project similar, either I think it's K-12 LTSP or LTSP itself, and using that as a basis for a board-wide, not just infrastructure, but terminal-based computing throughout these throughout the entire school district. So not only does he have the hardware and the soft, the application levels provided through Linux, but there's also a much broader management infrastructure, not just for on the tech side, but especially things like student records, grading, etc. So here's a small group, a small group of people who have been able to put together an extremely valuable and useful project. And as far as I understand, it's readily available. I'll have to double check on that. I'm not completely sure because it's been a while since we've talked about it. But what really struck me is that, here we have a system that can pretty much do anything that's really needed. And when the last I talked to them, their goal was to, get rid of all the moving parts in these computers, because really, using a terminal-based approach to providing these services, when one goes down, pull it out, put in the next one, nothing changes. This is allowing them to really provide a great deal of services to the entire school board in a way that's financially, responsible and attainable. Throughout other areas, just trying to remember a couple of things. I do know of a couple of projects where people are trying to introduce Linux, if not on a larger basis, and certainly as trying to make forays into individual schools. I suspect that there's still a lot more than I'm hearing about going on.
Yeah.
Mostly because, that's typical. When people do start up, they may not be aware of the much larger community out there and the interests that people have to try to foster Linux in education.
Yeah. Let me tell you about a phenomenon that I view here happening in the States. I can't speak for Canada. And I think that Stan Blank, the next member of the panel I will introduce, can appreciate this. Being is that he comes from the high school level and teaches in that arena, and that I teach on the college level, and I have found that the typical people in academia, I'm really referring to administration within academia here in the States, and this is no surprise to many, work ponderously slow. That they take not just years to make changes, but oft times decades to make any significant changes. And so although Linux is making lots of penetration in infrastructure areas in the boards and nails of building networks on college campuses, it has not entered the curriculum in very many colleges. The college I teach at has an enormous wealth from the standpoint that they have three teachers that are certified in Linux, a wonderful opportunity for a school to take advantage of, but they won't even touch Linux curriculum because it is such a pain to go before the Northwestern boards and get curriculum approved and then get the state to approve funding for low economic students and things like that. It turns into this ponderously slow, decades-long process to evolve curriculum. So where I've seen it, at least here in the States, where I've seen change that's come along more rapidly, is in the high school area. Particularly with high schools that are not prep school focused, high schools that are focused on really teaching their students real job skills have really been very quick on the uptake. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to go ahead now and introduce Stan Blank, let you talk about yourself and the experiences that you've had building your Beowulf cluster at your high school.
Okay. My name's Stan Blank, and I have been teaching for 25 years here at Wayne City. We are in the middle of nowhere in southern Illinois. Originally, our computer science program started around 1980 with the Commodore VIC-20, if anyone remembers that. Also, we were able to purchase some, if I remember correctly, some Texas Instruments TI-99-4As for like $50 from Walmart, so we had a few of those lying around, and that's the beginning. Progressed to Apple II, Apple II Plus, Apple IIe, AppleSoft Basic, moved to IBM-compatible machines about 10 years ago. My switch to Linux occurred, I think, 2 years ago. Not a total switch, but the move toward Linux occurred about 2 years ago. I finally got sick and tired of that other operating system locking up, and we tried to program in OpenGL and Glut. In Linux, we haven't found that to be the case, and so we've been pretty happy along those lines. The clustering experience that we are working with began also a couple of years ago. I was walking through a grocery store and happened to see a journal called Maxim Linux. I think it's defunct now, but there was an article on Beowulf clustering and using Mosix. Since I was still, and I guess at this point still am naive, picked it up, thought it'd be an easy thing to do, and found out I knew nothing about plain vanilla clusters. I knew nothing, or plain vanilla kernels, knew nothing about compiling a kernel. The first attempts were a disaster. From that point, we started researching PVM, MPI, and eventually settled on what we call MPISH, I guess the people that produce the software like to pronounce each letter, but it's easy for us to say MPISH in this part of the country. And that's our history as far as clustering is concerned. We had no illusions, I think, of breaking new ground. It just seemed like a neat thing to do. I don't have a set curriculum in my computer science class. The kids seem to enjoy working with graphics a lot. They enjoy doing interesting things, and I'm still a kid at 47, and I enjoy the same type of stuff. So we pretty much have 13 kids in my class. Now I have 13 kids going 13 different directions. So we just have a lot of fun. I'd like to comment on what you mentioned about administration. We sort of call it the inertia of Microsoft around here. It is extremely difficult to make any kinds of change, even at the high school level. There's secretaries in the office that, whenever the time changes in October and April, call me and ask, what do I do because I have this message on my machine saying that the time has changed. Click OK. To switch to Linux in that situation seems to me to be kind of a daunting task, and that's just my perspective.
Well, yeah, I can certainly understand that the infrastructure side that is being experienced at the college I'm at is being done really without even asking.
Mm-hmm.
And as I think everybody on the regular panel here on the Linux show is what the normal business experience is for your typical business getting exposed in the back office to Linux products is that the admins just do it without telling anybody. And that has actually been the main process of evolution at Northwestern Business College to date is that we've just done it without telling anybody. And so little by little, we're replacing access terminals that people use for purposes like going out and getting their webmail, things like that, are being replaced with Linux machines. But again, this is infrastructure stuff that we're talking about. It is not curriculum. And to date, we have had no success talking the administration into adding Linux curriculum in the school.
I guess in my situation, since I am in charge of my curriculum, I just do it. Makes it easier in a small rural high school to do things like that. And you mentioned that at the high school level, it's easier to do such things.
It definitely is. And it also, at least the my experience, and tell me if I'm wrong here, but my experience in the high schools that I have talked to over the years, it appears to me, I made a comment earlier about prep school focus. The schools that have a prep school focus where their main, where their only goal is getting kids into college, they don't give a damn. They want Microsoft on the desktop of everything because in their perception that's the quickest road. And but schools that are interested in creating jobs are going to have a little bit more infrastructure-oriented curriculum.
Possibly. I really can't comment on that because this is the only school. I do teach a night class at SIU, but as far as the high school situation, this is pretty much the only place I've been. So.
Yep. Well, let's bring our other panelist in, Alex Yount. Alex emailed me after we made the announcement last week of what this week's show was going to be about, and I sort of focused the commentary of last week on colleges and high schools, because really that's what I'm familiar with, but got this email from Alex saying, you know, we're doing it in junior highs too. And at first, the letter was so well-informed and so knowledgeable, I honestly thought it was either a parent or an instructor at the school who was writing me. And it wasn't after I had read it a couple of times that I actually recognized the fact that this was a student contacting me. And so here we are with 14-year-old Alex Yount. Alex, tell us about yourself and what's going on in your middle school.
I'm currently at Klondike Middle
School. You're going to have to talk up.
I'm currently at Klondike Middle School. I'm an eighth grader. About 2 years ago, I read about a few projects online that dealt with Beowulf clusters in high school, and I thought that it would be a great idea to start at my school because not a lot of people knew about Linux. And I went around and asked a few teachers, and I got one teacher who sponsored a club, and we built a small Beowulf cluster out of Outcast machines with Token Ring. And last year, the support went away, but overall we taught around 12 students very in-depth Linux knowledge.
And so this really came from the students pushing it, from you pushing it, not from the school.
Nope. My school is, the entire school corporation is anti-Linux or open source. Totally. Oh, we are using Mozilla now.
And really?
Netscape.
That's amazing. That's utterly amazing. Boy, talk about resistance. It's remarkable you got far as you did. I'd like to ask you all a question, and Pete, why don't you start in this thing as this sort of plays to your real area of expertise. Let's talk for a moment about resources available to schools, and from Pete, from your perspective in terms of the kind of resources that the .orgs that you've been associated with have developed, and Stan and Alex, maybe you can tell us a little bit about the resources that you have had most success from, most benefit from, as you have been working on the various projects that you've worked on. So, Pete,
okay.
Go ahead.
I don't think I'll speak to specific applications. I mean, I can tell you about some of the applications we host at Sewell. I'd be more than happy. I think probably our two colleagues are probably better placed to answer what they're really using. But I can tell you that what I have seen here at Sewell has been very, eclectic's not the right word, but there has been quite a selection of, quite a breadth, if you will, of applications. One of the efforts has through school, the School Forge project, which is really has tried to be the Uber umbrella group, if you will, to try to bring in as many possible different organizations as possible, is to try to get create a central registry of all of these organizations.
Do you have a URL for that?
Sure. I'm going to the sewell.org, that's HTTP, SEUL.org/EDU, and just pull up the School Forge. Earl, I think that's www.schoolforge.
Is that a .org?
I think it's .net. Yeah,
okay.
It is.
Okay, so it's www.schoolforge.net.
Yeah. Now, there is, on the sewell.org, sewell.edu, excuse me, main page, a link to a software list being maintained. And I can give you the URL for that, too, if you'd like.
Sure. Why don't go ahead and give it to the people in the IRC.
Okay. It's richtech, richtech.ca/Sewell/. This is the Sewell Edu Educational Application Index. This is an attempt to, a very good attempt at that, to try to enumerate and describe a lot of the different applications available in user land and, to some extent, infrastructure for educators and educational users. Now, just looking down the application categories on the right-hand side of that page, there are like 65 different admin entries, 21 for astronomy, 22 for courseware, 6 for geography, language 74, presentation 11, quizzing 19, so, and there are a bunch of other categories there as well. One of the foci, if you will, of this site has been to try to provide not only mention of the packages, but also a description. How is it? What are people's experiences with it? I'm going to pull one up.
There's a lot of stuff here.
There is an awful lot of stuff there, yeah.
There's a way a lot of stuff here.
So, as far as how people are using, what's there, I mean, that's, to a big extent, it has to do with what people know about, and this is why I think that this effort here, the application index, I think is quite valuable. Although I haven't seen or heard of too many people referring to it outside of the Sewell Edu list. I know there's a lot of work put into this. If I look at GPeriodic, for instance, this is a periodic table browser, and I've been watching this for a little while now because it's one of the projects that we host. Let's pull this down, GPeriodic. I was quite impressed with it. Just if I can pull out one application as an example, it does give you the typical information that you really care about when you're looking at a periodic table, but it's undergone a great deal of development over the last 2 years. The maintainers have changed, and this is one thing that particularly stays with me about open source and free software is, you know, the projects take on a life of their own. We're no longer dealing with necessarily a finite linear lifespan to a project, but it seems to continue, sometimes grow exponentially. One thing that I also remember about GPeriodic, and I'm reading it in front of me, is that many of these applications have been internationalized, so they have support for various languages. The Tuesday, March 7th, 2000 entry reads, apparently there is now a full Dutch translation, although it doesn't use the GetText library. I think French is in here, German is in here as well. And the nice thing about this is it gives people who are working in creating educational software the ability to provide the support in the language that the students and the educators are going to use. This is often, I think, rare in a lot of the educational commercial software that I've seen in the past.
Yep. There's a couple hundred applications here. I didn't actually count them, but I mean, just doing a rough scan, there's got to be 350, 400 applications here.
Yeah, and it keeps growing.
That's quite a depth. Wow. Pretty good.
Yeah, a lot of people have done a great deal of work, and not just on creating and
21 astronomy applications.
Yeah.
That's quite a resource. I'm going to have to try a couple of these out. Stan and Alex, while you were working on your projects, was there any particular resources that you found of great specific aid?
May I go first?
Sure.
Okay.
Right in.
I think the sites, if you're talking about the Beowulf project, we use, first of all, I think the Beowulf Underground. That's the first site that we looked at. I think that's where I got the idea that there was a high school that had built a cluster and had talked about it on the Beowulf Underground. And I thought, well, you know, if they can talk about theirs, we can talk about ours. So that was the motivation. There were some links on that site that sent us to the Beowulf Project, which I still think is, what, beowulf.org, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
Yeah. From there, we went to the MPICH website, and that I think those three are probably the best sites that we've come across at this point. Now we are turning our sights toward distributed graphics, and the resource that we are using at this point, and I can give you the URL. I have it up in front of me if you want this. I don't know if anybody's interested in distributed graphics or not, but it is kind of interesting, the concept of building a cave or a cube virtual reality environment. We don't have the resources here to actually build such a structure, but it's kind of nice to watch an OpenGL application running on six different monitors showing six different aspects of the same, you know, the same object. But the URL is www.isl.uiuc.edu, it's the University of Illinois, / clustered, C-L-U-S-T-E-R-E-D, V-R, all one word, / clusteredvr.htm. And this will take you to the homepage of Syzygy, and the title is A Toolkit for Virtual Reality on PC Clusters, High-End VR, and Whatever Random Crap You Have Lying Around. And that's my kind of title. So it's a very good website. You can download the Syzygy package for Linux and go from there.
And Alex, what was something that you can cite that was real helpful to you?
The Beowulf Underground, I got my... there was a posting there on the front page about the CUDI project. It was a high school who built a cluster, and that was my main resource for building the club. And I, trying to think.
I'm going to ask you,
yeah.
Once you got your clusters built, and I don't care which of you jump in first, Stan or Alex, I have found that getting together with large groups of people, putting together Beowulf clusters has been a fun way to spend a Saturday afternoon. But once we've done it and you've run the benchmark test, there's really not much else you can do with it. Have you actually found uses? Now, I know, Stan, you're talking graphics. There's a use. Have you come up with any other uses that you've actually used the clusters for?
Well, you've hit the nail right on the head. We ran the benchmarks and thought, this is really neat. Now what do we do? And I purchased a book on MPI programming with every intention of digging into that and, you know, went a different direction. It seemed to me a little kludgy to try to develop, you know, take some of the software we're working on in GLUT programming and OpenGL graphics programming and trying to, you know, to implement that in OpenGL was really, you know, something that I don't have the expertise to tackle at this point. So we went a different direction.
Okay. And Alex?
On our cluster, my main goal was just to basically teach about Linux and how to run a cluster.
Yep.
We didn't, by the time the cluster ended and the club ended, we didn't have any specific application we were running.
So other than SETI at home, not much. I tell you, though, this is something that is really going to be very soon a high-demand area for job training. I know it from personal experience because all up and down I-88 here in the extreme western suburbs of Chicago is a highway called I-88, which is lined by small high-tech communities much like Silicon Valley. We call it the Silicon Prairie. And there are all kinds of studios opening up offices along I-88 because of the technological base available here, and wages are relatively cheap here. And I know of several of these studios that are starting to build clusters, but they as of yet have no manpower nor no clue how to actually manage them. And so this is going to become a eventually a very high demand job skill in the future, as being able to manage not only rendering clusters but scientific clusters, and I'm quite sure we're going to the other clustering applications coming out of the enterprise insurance industries, things like that as well.
Well, it was a heck of a lot of fun, and I want to invite Alex to move to Wayne City, and we would be happy to try to, you know, further his career in any way we can.
What I will do is make sure that you get each other's email address.
That would be great. Thanks.
Because as an educator, I think you can sense his frustration.
Oh, yeah. And I'm not too certain. Alex, did you by any chance email anyone on the Beowulf Underground? I received some emails from some middle school students a year or so ago.
I did.
Yes. Did you email me, perhaps?
I truly don't know.
Okay, because it seems like I definitely remember receiving an email from an Alex, and I thought all evening maybe that's you. So
small world if it was.
Yes.
But, well, very, very interesting. A couple of other resources I would like to definitely address to people's attention is we do have a community resource out there called sourceforge.org that, the website at Sewell, SourceForge does have a tremendous resource of open source software. There's some, 17,000 projects there right now, of which a third of them are probably Windows open source projects. And this is a tremendous resource, not only for business, but for education as well. You may not find 21 different astronomy programs listed at sourceforge.org, but at least in terms of the depth and breadth of general server software, you will find it at that particular resource. Last comment I'd like to make as a resource, any educators that may be listening, I got a surprising amount of email over the course of the last week of people who had heard secondhand that we were going to be doing the show tonight, talking about clustering in school and uses of Linux in school, and contacted me, not about clusters, but they contacted me about streaming media off of, in particular, Icecast. And for those of you who are out there listening and I have not had the time to respond to any of you, we are going to be posting a piece of resource information on our website sometime in the next 2 weeks about a simplified way of building streaming servers, and we're going to make an image available to schools to get a hold of so that they don't have to compile all of the various pieces to get a streaming server running. But they can go ahead and contact us at staff@thelinuxshow.com if they're too impatient to wait for us to pop it up on the website. That is it. We're way out of time. It's 9:30 here in Chicago. I'd like to thank the three of you for joining us for the second half of the show. Pete, Alex, and Stan, I really appreciate it. Periodically, about once every 6 months or so, we do have these shows about what's going on in the world of education, so we may be calling on you again in the future.
Anytime.
Would love to have you back on again. Alex, I also want to put you in contact with a very close friend of the Linux Show. We're going to put you in contact with the founder of Fat Linux. Fat Linux is one of the more popular Linux distributions.
Yeah,
the show. Fat was founded by Cameron Cooper at the age of 14. I'd say Fat Linux is probably, if you were to list it within all the various Linux distributions, he's definitely in the top 10, probably somewhere around 7 or 8 on the hierarchy list of distributions. But Cameron is now at the old age of 18 years old, still running Fat Linux very successfully as a commercial enterprise. And I think he will appreciate you, and I'm going to get the two of you together offline after the show. So thanks again, everyone, for joining us. This has been the Tuesday night edition of the Linux Show. Everybody come back next week. Can't promise, but I think it's finally going to happen. I think Will Wheaton's going to be with us next week. Everybody hang in for updated news on the Will Wheaton adventure that we've been promising for week after week. He's getting close. Very soon, I promise, we'll get him. So until then, this has been the Linux Show. Everybody hang in. We're out of here.
So you need a mail server, huh? Well, check out one of our sponsors. What? The Linux Show has sponsors? Yeah, well, how the hell do you think we pay the bandwidth bill around here? No, it's really more the phone bill, not the bandwidth bill. Phone bill is killing us. But anyways, back to our sponsor. Check out the folks at www.littlebluebox.com and buy their stuff and sponsor.